This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 79.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we talk with marathoner and blogger Danielle Hastings. She joins us to talk about her struggle with an eating disorder and her journey to run a marathon in all 50 states before age 30. And in this episode's quick tip, Angie will tell you about race pacing bands. And to train for a marathon with us, find out how to join the Academy by visiting marathontrainingacademy.com. Well, Angie's good to be back sitting in front of the microphone with you. Since we last recorded, I run a half marathon in Modesto, California, and you have run a full marathon in St. Louis, Missouri. So I guess we have a lot to recap before we even get into the rest of the show.
This might end up being a long episode. Bear with us, folks.
Ladies first.
Well, your half marathon was first.
Oh, we have to go in chronological order.
Yes, we do.
All right. So,
tell us what made you go to Modesto, California in the first place.
I grew up in Modesto, believe it or not.
And the one good thing that came out of Modesto?
No. My parents have lived in Modesto almost all their lives, and they have now moved to the Washington coast. And I flew out there to help them pack up their house. They gave us some stuff, so I rented a truck and drove it back. My son Riley and I went out there, and we had a massive yard sale because they were really downsizing their lives, and it just coincided with the weekend of the Modesto Marathon. So Dad and I ran the half together. We ran it at a comfortable pace for him. We finished in about 2 hours and 24 minutes. We finished the half marathon right as the first full marathoner was crossing the finish line. We actually saw him break the tape.
That is so cool. I've never seen the tape broken before in real life.
It was kind of weird, because as I was coming toward the finishing line, people were cheering and yelling and taking pictures. And
it wasn't for you.
It wasn't for me. It was for that full marathoner right behind me who just kind of passed me and then broke the tape. And instantly I saw a reporter, you know, come up to him, ask him his name. And then that was it. But we had a good time running together. It requires discipline to be able to run slower than you're used to, because I'm used to finishing half marathons under 2 hours. So I really had to make a conscious effort to run slower. And even though my pace was slower, I was still tired at the end, because I think I took as many steps.
Well, just being on your feet for 2.5 hours,
yeah.
No matter if you run it fast or slow. In fact, some of the back-of-the-pack runners, I think it's almost harder, because you're just on your feet and your body is going through that much effort for, you know, a longer time. So they put in just as much work, or if not more.
It's true. It's better just to run fast, right? Just get it over with. Unless you're doing it, you know, with a friend or your dad, like in my case.
Exactly. So any other interesting moments during the half marathon or surrounding the event?
While we were on the course, I got to pull up next to and run with Bart Yasso for a little while. And
well, that's awesome.
Yeah, he was just out there plodding along. He's got horrible running form, the poor guy.
Well, he's got advanced, what is it, Lyme disease?
Yeah. He's an old soldier, you know. He just goes and... I thought, what an opportunity to talk to him. I was a little bit reserved about doing that. There was a moment where no one was running with him or talking to him, so I just pulled up next to him and asked him if he is working on a new book or anything. He said he's going to do a sequel to his book, My Life on the Run.
Oh, that's good.
And I said we had him on our podcast and interviewed him. He seemed to remember who we were. And says he would love to come back on the podcast someday.
And this time maybe we won't hang up on him several times.
Yeah, this time we'll have our technology working, hopefully. That was one of our very early interviews there.
Yes, it was. And that's an excellent book, by the way. If people haven't read My Life on the Run by Bart Yasso, check it out and be looking forward to his sequel.
So overall, Modesto Marathon and Half Marathon is a good race. It's flat. There's only one hill. It's when you go over an overpass to cross over the highway. It's well supported. The weather was great. You can check out my full race recap that I wrote over at our blog, marathontrainingacademy.com. Okay, Angie, so you recently ran a marathon, and you're still sore. That's how recent it is, probably, right?
Yes, it's still fresh on my mind and my muscles. Yeah, this is actually, you kind of ran an opportunistic half marathon, and this marathon was kind of the same way for me. I was going to be in St. Louis for a coaching clinic on Friday and Saturday, And then I knew that the Go St. Louis Marathon was on a Sunday. So I was like, hey, why not stay another night and do the marathon?
Yeah.
I'd never done that particular race before, even though I've already completed Missouri for my 50 states. But, you know, can't pass up a marathon when it's so convenient. And, you know, I'd heard good things about the race.
And we interviewed the race director, Nancy Lieberman, a couple of years ago.
Yes, we did.
So we knew a little bit about the Go St. Louis Marathon, although neither of us had had been there and run it.
That's right. So I got to stay at the Drury Plaza Hotel, which is downtown St. Louis, right by the Arch.
You could look out your window and see the Arch.
I did, yeah. The back window was like right across the street from the Arch. It was just ideal.
So what did you think of the race?
The race was good.
Was it tough?
It was. It's definitely not a flat one. You probably won't PR there unless you train on that particular course. And the weather started out about 60 degrees at 7 in the morning. So the heat kept building throughout the run. And I think it was probably mid-70s by the time I finished around 11 o'clock. So it was feeling warm, and the hills definitely were not my friend, especially towards the end of the race. It was a challenging marathon, but it was really beautiful. You know, it took us through several areas of St. Louis, through the Forest Park area, downtown. I thought the course was well put together, even though I was really hating the hills after mile 20. So, and I had kind of had a goal in the back of my mind that I wanted to finish in less than 4 hours. And that was all good until about mile 18 when I decided that I would live to fight another day.
So mile 18, you knew you wouldn't break 4 hours.
I knew I wouldn't break 4 hours, and I thought, you know, I really don't want to kill myself in these hills. I've got a marathon coming up in 2 weeks. I came up actually on my friend who was running the race, and she had gotten some bad cramps in her calves. And so I kind of talked to her for a little bit and encouraged her, and she's like, go on, you know, and finish strong. And I was like, okay, bye. So you see what
some
kind of friend I am.
Are, yeah.
I know. Well, I was thinking, if it was me and, you know, I was going slower than I wanted to and a friend came up, I would just be like, please go on. Don't let me hold you back. And I would have felt like embarrassed. And if someone just like slowed down to run with me out of pity.
So the difference between you and I is that you have to run every marathon competitively to try to get a great time, to beat your time, whatever. And I could run a marathon like half that I did with my dad and just be there for the social part of it and not really care about my time.
Yeah, I guess maybe.
Like, you would feel like a loser if you ran a slow marathon.
Well, no, I have run slow marathons.
But not because you wanted to.
Because I was running with you mostly. No, I don't know. I guess there is that competitive part of me. And, yeah, maybe I'm not a very nice person.
So you'd rather just try to finish fast than run with your friend.
Well, I guess I look at it from, maybe I think people think like I do. Like, I wouldn't want someone to slow down their pace just to run with me.
Mm-hmm.
I would feel like awkward and embarrassed. Like, please go on. I'd be like, you know, trying to get them to go on.
You would hate the feeling that you're slowing someone down.
Exactly. And so if someone tells me, go on, you look strong, I'm fine, kind of thing, I take their word for it.
Yeah.
So hopefully it doesn't damage our friendship, but...
Well, my dad told me that. He says, hey, you don't have to run with me. Just go for it. And I said, well, there'll be lots of opportunities to run a fast half marathon, but we don't get to run together that often. So
Okay. We
talked the whole time. We had a blast.
Now you're making me feel really bad.
Good.
Well, I have heard that it's more fun in the back of the pack. Actually, the lady we're interviewing on the podcast today, Danielle, did the St. Louis Marathon as well. She and her friend Amanda had done a marathon the day before in Evansville, Indiana. And then they were coming to St. Louis. I said, hey, you know, if you're going to be here, share my hotel room with me. And so we got to meet and went to a Marathon Maniac dinner on Saturday night, met a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you talk marathon, stories come up and finishing times. And people found out what my marathon PR was. They're like, whoa, you are so fast. I'm like, no, I'm not, actually. I kind of felt like as close to elite as I'll ever feel in their company because, you know, a lot of them had run 100 marathons. And when you do so many marathons, it obviously slows down your finishing time for the most part. I felt like a baby maniac because I'd run so few marathons. And
so few is 14.
14. Some of them had run, there's this one guy, he's run a marathon in every continent. In fact, Danielle was telling me a story later how he ran a marathon in Chile and then very quickly ran a marathon in Antarctica.
Wow.
And then somehow his flight from Antarctica was delayed because of bad weather, and he didn't get back to his home airport when he was supposed to, and he had another marathon planned for that weekend. So he basically got in and then had to leave an hour and a half later without even going home to go to another marathon. So it was just like the kind of company I was in, just, you know, these amazing stories about back-to-back marathons and running and all over the world, and I just felt like in awe.
Is that the guy that Danielle was teasing, saying, "I don't really think you have a wife, she's just make-believe"?
That was a different one. Yeah, because it's kind of like, wow, you know, all that traveling and everything, you would have to have a really supportive family, because it's really, you know, can be very consuming, just, you know, traveling and running. And
yeah, maybe they came out for the first marathon to see you finish. And
well, it's pretty anticlimactic after you've done several marathons. I mean, I didn't have anyone there supporting me. And it was only my 14th marathon.
So. I was here with the kids, so that was supporting me.
And that's fine with me. And I think most of these people, they have kind of like a community, a maniac community that they see at these races. It's like friends, and, you know, that's their support system. And they often run together. And so it was kind of fun to be able to meet some new people and get to know Danielle and her friend Amanda a little bit and enjoy seeing them. So
that was quite an action-packed weekend.
It was very busy. It was not relaxing at all, because I was in these classes from 8 to 5 for 2 days, and pretty much my brain was fried.
Yeah.
Been running a marathon the next day and driving back. And
then going to the maniac dinner and meeting Danielle. Because we had interviewed her a couple weeks before, so it's kind of cool to be able to meet someone that you've interviewed only known online.
Yeah, it was very cool. So it was a great weekend, but I'm tired, and I got home and like fell asleep on the couch right away, and been taking naps the last couple of days. And for some reason, just all the hills and I guess the heat really kind of beat my body up. So I've been kind of limping around, which is weird, because when we did the New Orleans marathon, I felt great. You know, I wasn't sore or nothing. So definitely you can tell I'm not hill trained. My finishing time was 4 hours, 7 minutes, and 6 seconds. Nothing to brag about, but, you know, it was still good.
Yeah, that's a good time.
I was happy. It was a good experience. It was fun.
Okay, well, Angie wants to read 2 emails before we get into our interview with T-Rex runner Daniel Hastings.
All right, this first one says, "Hi, Angie and Trevor. I've been listening to your podcast for about 2 years and want to say thank you. I truly appreciate your message affirming that I have what it takes to run a marathon. I have been running off and on for 20-plus years, mostly 3 miles at a time. 4.5 years ago, I signed up to run a half marathon here in Houston. The hardest part for me was going from 3 to 4 miles the first time. I ran 3 half marathons in the last 3 years with a PR of 2 hours and 2 minutes. This past year, I set a new challenge for myself and set out to run my first full marathon. I figured that at age 57, it was only going to get harder from here on. I had 3 personal goals for the Houston Chevron Marathon. Number 1, finish, preferably with my dignity intact. Number 2, run the whole race. And number 3, finish in under 5 hours. I came in at 4 hours and 56 minutes after running a moderate, even pace. Following your advice, I had a tested fueling strategy. I feel like I had a successful first time out for a full marathon, and I'm proud of what I achieved. I attribute part of that success to the information and positive attitude and encouragement I got from listening to you two. I did not have a personal mantra for the tough times, but I did maintain a positive mental attitude. On my solitary training runs, I came to realize that I have no obstacles before me but those that I set before myself. I did tell myself that I do have what it takes to run a marathon and change my life, and I realized that it was true. I passed the 20-mile marker for the wall without any fanfare and cruised down the road to finish strong, happy, and with a smile on my face. I don't know if I really changed my life, but I do know now that I'm a marathon runner, and that feels good deep down inside. In retrospect, I kind of thought it would be harder at the end. Not that it was easy, but it was not a death march either. I guess I'm lucky that I didn't have to release the Kraken. With thanks and fond regards, Larry."
Well, thank you for that nice email, Larry. He was on his feet for 5 hours, so definitely could have been really tiring at the end. He lucked out that time.
Luck had nothing to do with it. He was well-trained and well-prepared.
That's right. No, but congratulations on running that marathon there in Houston, and good luck on your next one if you choose to do this sort of thing again.
That's right. Sounds like you will. The second one says, "Trevor and Angie, my wife and I have been longtime listeners. We both really enjoy the podcast. My race distance of choice is 50K and hers is 5K, yet we both get so much from your show. So, of course, I think it's awesome how many ultra marathon runners you've had on the podcast. Just wanted to say thanks for the great show and motivation. And that comes from Alex in Phoenix, Arizona.
All right. Good snapshot there on what kind of people listen to our podcast. Alex is an ultra runner. His wife runs 5Ks. I've wondered if we've had too many ultra marathoners on our show, you know, in recent times.
We've gone off the deep end.
But I'm glad that people like those interviews because...
Well, I think there's a lot to learn from ultra runners because no matter where you're at on your running journey, you're still facing challenges. You're still pushing past barriers. And that's a lot of what ultra marathons are. It's just taking on personal challenges and finding that determination and courage from inside of you. And, you know, it takes determination to run 5Ks as well.
Yes.
I think there's something for everyone.
That's right.
Now, in the interview we're going to play as we talk with Danielle, she's going to be talking about her struggle with an eating disorder. And we do want to warn listeners that if you've struggled with an eating disorder currently or in the past, that something in this episode might be triggering for you. So we want you to be aware of that. But I also think that it's going to be a really valuable episode for a lot of us. Even if you've never struggled with an eating disorder, you might have known somebody who does or has in the past. And so I think it's going to be a lot of great information. So I think this episode is going to be very helpful to help understand eating disorders because they do affect so many people.
Danielle Hastings is a 27-year-old marathoner. She lives in South Carolina. She has a goal of running a marathon in every state before she turns 30. And so far, she's got about 25 states completed. She blogs about her journey over at trexrunner.com and is a really fantastic writer, very entertaining. Her blog has been featured by Runner's World and other running websites. And recently, she began a series of posts talking about her 11-year struggle with an eating disorder. The purpose is to raise awareness about eating disorders and how they affect so many, and we'll talk about that on this episode. Angie, part of the interview we had with her, she mentioned having surgery, but she didn't really go into details about what that surgery was that she had done.
When I talked to her just recently when I met her, she was, I believe, 45 days post-op. And she had a procedure done to control severe reflux that was caused by her eating disorder. And she was recovering very well. And this was her first marathon back. And she did a double marathon. So she had done one the day before as well. And, you know, handled it well. So she's healthy and, you know, running strong and a very inspirational person.
All right. So I know you're going to enjoy this. We're going to go ahead and get into it right now.
Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way. Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way.
All right, so when did you start running and why?
Well, I've started running like probably 8 times over the course of my life, but the most recent time, and I think everybody kind of has a story like that, you know, we all start and stop, but I think my most recent time was I got married pretty young and got divorced. And when I realized that the marriage wasn't going very well, it was like a month into it. And I was kind of like, crap, what am I going to do now? You know, and I was 23 and just didn't know what I was doing. So I started just running to get out of the house. And the miles just kept adding up and adding up. And I got lost on a run one day. I meant to do 8 miles and ended up doing 11. And I was like, well, crap, that's like 2 miles short of a half marathon. So I might as well do a half marathon. And I crossed that finish line and I just thought, no way, like no way am I ever going to run a marathon. And then of course, a week later, I had signed up for one and, you know, totally normal. And then I've been running ever since, you know, for the most part, that's been it.
You signed up for that first marathon. I mean, did someone dare you to do it or just kind of the elation over finishing that half marathon is what you, kind of carried you through to sign up for the full?
You know, it was really just the elation and I really wanted to see if I could do it. And then I realized that running farther would keep me out of my house longer, which would, you know, let me avoid my problems. So I just thought, well, let me see if I can do it. And I figured I had already gone halfway. And of course, before I ever signed up for, before I ever first ran my marathon, I signed up for 5. Okay. So I like immediately was not only going to do one marathon, I was going to do all of the marathons in the world, all over, you know, all over the country. And,
that's intense. Wow.
Yeah. So it was ridiculous. It was stupid really, because I had no idea what I was doing, but I was like, oh, whatever. These sound fun. Let's do that.
So you're the kind of person when you do something, you really do it all the way, huh?
I lost you a little bit there, but I know what you're trying to say. And yes, I'm exactly that type of person. I can't do anything in moderation. So I kind of have to either go big or go home, I guess. And marathoning's the perfect sport for that.
So since running your first marathon, you have become a marathon maniac and you've completed 30 marathons.
Yes.
Why did you first become a maniac and what do you enjoy about the maniac community?
Well, I'm a very compulsive researcher. I have to know everything about what I'm doing. And I actually came across the Maniacs group from a blog that I was reading about different marathons all over the country. And the girl was trying to do a marathon in every state and she was a maniac. And reading about it, I was like, wow, those people are so cool and they're crazy and they understand, you know, the different things that I'm interested in. And they're not going to think I'm weird because they're running more marathons than me. So I knew I wanted to join that group before I ever ran a marathon. Immediately, I had my sights set on qualifying, and I actually broke my hip after my first marathon. I had a stress fracture thanks to my ridiculous training.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so I didn't qualify right away, and it took me longer than I planned on. But the Maniacs has been just this incredible community and incredible experience. It's like having family everywhere you go, but like family you like. You know what I mean? Like, you know, not your weird aunt, but like cool family that you can relate to. You always have something to talk about. Even with somebody who, you know, 50 years older than you, you can talk about a race that you both did or other people that you both know. And you just always have this group of people that's there for you. And, you know, if you're having a bad day, you can just go up to a maniac and talk to them. So they've just become my closest friends, I guess by default, because I spend the most time with them, but they're a great group of people.
I think that's neat. At one race I did, I was just sitting at a table before the race, and I ended up talking with a couple of maniacs. And this was before I ever had in my head that I could become one or even knew what it was about. And we were just, you know, talking, running races. And she says, all you'd have to do is run two marathons in 2 weeks or three months. And I'm like, yeah, but I've got three young kids at home. I don't have time. She's like, oh, yeah, you do. You know, there's tons of people who do that. And it's like, it's stuck in my head. I could not get it out. And I knew I had to become a maniac after that. So
yeah.
It's infectious, really. It is
infectious. And I've met so many people just randomly at marathons. And they ask me about the shirt. And I start telling them. And, you know, now those people are going for the highest levels of maniacs. And they're like, you started it. I'm like, sorry. Sorry to your family and your bank account. But it's fun.
So you've set the goal of running a marathon in all 50 states before you turn 30. Can you tell us about this goal? Why did you choose to do that?
You know, when I got divorced, I was 25 by that time. And really, I just figured, okay, by the time I get my life together and get married again and have kids, I'll probably be 30-ish. So I need to get this out of my system. You know, because you have three kids, so you know, I mean, I'm sure it's really, really hard to schedule all this and just have time to train, but also it's expensive. I'm not going to pretend like it's not. So I figured now would be a good time to do that and just really enjoy the time I have to myself before I devote my time to my family. So
you have,
I've 20, set that
you have 20 states left, right? You've run 30 so far.
I've run 30 marathons, but 25 states. I've repeated a few states. So yeah, I'm halfway done.
Have you done Missouri?
I have not done Missouri yet. That's funny that you ask because I was planning to do Missouri in November at the Bass Pro Shops Marathon.
Okay.
The medal is camo and, you know, I'm from South Carolina, so I should have that. But I may actually be doing the Go St. Louis Marathon the first weekend in April. It's stupid, but there's a double with a marathon in Indiana and I'm like, well, I could save money on a plane ticket, so maybe I should do both.
You should, because I'm be doing Go St. Louis here pretty soon. So,
oh, don't tell me that, Angie. I don't need another reason to do it, but I might. I'll let you know.
We could meet, and that would be really cool. Yeah, I'm doing one 2 weeks later, and I kind of at the spur of the moment decided to do Go St. Louis, even though I've already done Missouri. It's just so close, and I've never done that race before, you know. So I've got to do.
Yeah, I've heard good things about it. I mean, it seems like it'd be really fun. So. We'll see. All I can see are dollar signs. I'm like, well, it saved me money on a plane ticket, and I'm already going to be out there anyway. And that's one more marathon, really.
Exactly.
We'll see.
Oh, that's neat. So of all the marathons that you've done, which one stands out in your mind? I mean, I'm thinking most fun, maybe most difficult, maybe most meaningful. You know, tell us about a few of the races that you've done that stand out to you.
That's obviously a tough one for me, but if I had to pick two, Hatfield McCoy in West Virginia, it's on the West Virginia-Kentucky border. I am obsessed with that race. I can't get enough of it. It's really, really small, and it's in the middle of nowhere, and you think, like, why am I going? But the people are amazing, and it's all based around the Hatfield-McCoy feud, which I'm a big history nerd, so to me that's like, ooh, let's go learn about history. And the race director is a Hatfield, and he divides the teams, or the runners, into two teams, the Hatfields and McCoys, and whoever has the lowest total time wins the feud for that year, which, you know, I loved that. They do a reenactment of the feud at the pasta dinner the night before, which is held in the high school auditorium. Everybody's dressed up in character. They have these really cute door prizes. I mean, it's just like, it's an experience, and you can tell the community is just so proud of this race, and they're proud of what they're doing. And so I love that, but that's really small. I mean, last year they were trying to get to 500 total participants in the half and the full. This year it's growing a lot, and I like to think I'm responsible for that thanks to my blog post, but it's probably not true. But I'm probably going to go back this year. I love it, and I would recommend that to anybody. And then on the opposite end of that spectrum, I'm obsessed with Chicago. I think it's an incredible experience. I'm not a big race person, like big in terms of the number of people, but it was so well organized. The crowd support's phenomenal. It's a cool city. You run through so many different neighborhoods. And I really felt like you got not only a great tour, but you weren't just a number. And that's something that I hate feeling like I'm just a number at a race. And Chicago, just everybody got so into it. And I just had the most wonderful weekend there. And I would love to do it again. I wish it wasn't so expensive, but it's fantastic.
Okay, I got the next question. Tell us about your approach to running marathons. Are you there to try to set PRs at a lot of these, or just finish? Do you run fast, run slow?
My approach to marathons has changed a lot over the course of the time that I've been doing them. When I first started, I wanted to PR every race. I think most people do that. And then you realize that that's not really possible, especially when you start running a lot of marathons. Your body just, it's not realistic to expect yourself to go out and get better every single time. Every once in a while, I'll set a goal for a specific race. Like Chicago, I really wanted to do well in. And so I had my friend pace me. And it actually ended up being my second fastest time ever, which I was completely unexpected. I hadn't really been training for it. But that race, I wanted to do well. But for the vast majority of them, I just want to go out and have a great time. I want to meet new people, take pictures with my friends. And the way I'm looking at it is, the races that I've PR'd in have been great because I PR'd, but in terms of memories, those aren't my most fun. You know, it's not the experience I enjoyed the most. I'm thrilled that I PR'd in them, but at the end of the day, I'm thinking to myself, why am I doing this? It's not so I can PR in every state. It's so I can make new friends and just make memories that are going to last me a lifetime. So I try to keep that in perspective when I'm running. Also, I'm like kind of lazy, which is like another reason that I like to have fun, but really I just don't like to train that much. So,
and you're right. If you're going out for a PR, then you're really nervous about, you know, when you start and staying on pace, and you know, anything gets in your way, it's an irritation. And so, yeah,
it takes fun out of it.
It can.
Yeah. I don't like to put that pressure on myself. So.
So how do you go about choosing marathons, and how do you keep your race schedule straight?
Well, that implies that I keep my race schedule straight, which I don't always. But like I said, I'm obsessed with research, and it's so important to me to pick races that are really well done. And I was a geography major in college, which is really random, but I think it says a lot about my approach to picking marathons, because it's really important to me to pick races that are representative of the area where they're found. So something like Hatfield McCoy, where it's specifically based on the culture of that community, is what I want to be doing. Not to bash the rock and roll crowd, but it's not my scene. I want to be doing something that's really personal and really unique. If the race directors are from that area, all the better. I feel like you're getting a tour of the city where you're going. I love races that utilize local resources. It's really important to me to support local communities, and that's mostly how I pick them. I would say I look for races that are locally based, get great reviews. I don't really care about the course because, like I said, I'm not usually going out to PR, so if it's really hilly, I'm like, oh, well, you know, just book my flight for later, but I don't care about that. But Also, if a ton of my friends are going, that can sometimes play a role, but I'm pretty picky about the races I do. And once I have my mind made up, it's pretty hard to change it. So
you're telling us you're a marathon guide junkie?
I am a marathon guide junkie. And it goes beyond that. I mean, I'll read sites, you know, marathon guide, but any race review I can find. I love blogs about marathons, but not if they talk about how the person ran it. Like, I don't care about that. I want to read about, you know, what was the expo like and what was the post-race party like and what did you see along the course? And so that's how I pick them. Well, and I have a spreadsheet, like a really aggressive spreadsheet for keeping track of them.
You have to if you're scheduling multiple marathons in a year or possibly even in a weekend, just to keep everything straight. I actually first ran across your blog, and Danielle has a very entertaining blog called The T-Rex Runner. And I was just researching, I think it was Route 66, which we did back in November, and I came across your blog and, you know, read your race recap and everything, and then started following your blog at that time. And I really don't follow many blogs, but somehow you just kind of connected me with, I don't know, marathons and sarcasm and the whole social atmosphere of it.
Yeah. Plenty of sarcasm to be found on my blog for sure.
So I'm interested in knowing, how did the T-Rex alter ego come about and why did you start blogging?
Well, I have always enjoyed writing, but when I realized that I was going to be doing all these races, they started to blend together. And I realized that after I ran my third marathon, which now seems ridiculous that like three marathons would run together because I've done 30 at this point. But at the time I was like, you know what? The more I do, the more it's going to be hard for me to remember. And so I wanted to just start writing it down. And I never thought that people would read about it or care, but I was like, you know what? At least I'll have this written down so I can go back and read through them and remember what I did. And the Baltimore Marathon is where the T-Rex alter ego came in. I've been thinking about what to call the blog, my hypothetical blog that I hadn't started yet. And I was looking through the race pictures from Baltimore, and there was this picture of me and my leg muscles just looked gigantic. And I mean, if anybody who looks at the picture is going to say that's ridiculous, but I just thought my legs looked huge and my arms were like kind of awkwardly high up and really, really skinny at that time for whatever reason. And I just thought, I was like, oh my gosh, I look like a T-Rex. And I was like, well, that's kind of funny, like T-Rex runner. Okay, well, you know, that is 2 months later, that whole internet meme with the T-Rex hates push-ups and T-Rex, all that stuff came out. And I was like, oh man, everyone's going to think I started because of that. But no, it's just one awkward picture that I thought I looked like a T-Rex, and that's where it comes from. So it's stuck ever since, I guess.
I don't see very many marathon photos, you know, those people that photograph you. I don't see very many of those of myself that I like, you know.
No, like, they're all terrible.
One out of 29 or however many they take.
Yeah. The rest are on there like deleting, like, I hope no one sees this one.
No, I know. And I always feel like somehow I've gained like 20 pounds in all my marathon pictures. I don't know what it is, but I'm like, I know I don't look like that in real life.
It's the angle. They're on the ground crouched. And so your lower half is like, you know, closer to the camera. It's horrible. I know.
It is. It's definitely not good. I've ordered no race pictures of myself ever. I've never bought a single one.
I haven't either.
Well, they're like $30 a pop.
But they're like $20 and you look awful. So. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, you've recently done a series on your blog on a very serious topic, and you know that's one of the reasons I wanted you to come on the podcast to talk about, and it's about eating disorders. And you talk very candidly about your longtime struggle with an eating disorder. So I'm interested to know, what point in your life did you know that you had an eating disorder to start out with?
You know, I thought about this today, realizing that you were going to ask this question, and I realized that I really didn't know. And I think I like to think of myself as being pretty self-aware. And so I knew that what I was doing wasn't normal, but I think within the eating disorder community, if we call that a community, that's weird to say, but there's a tendency to think that you're not worthy of treatment. You're not sick enough to demand other people's time. And I realize now that I think that's what I was doing. Like, I never saw myself as having a huge problem because I just didn't want to be demanding of anybody else. So I would say that it occurred to me that I had some type of eating issue probably a year into it. But to this day, I'm not even sure I grasp the seriousness of it fully. I think other people looking outside, from the outside looking in, would say it's worse than I would say it is. But, you know, maybe that's just denial. I don't know. So I would say, I guess around the time I was 17, I probably realized that it was an issue, but I wasn't prepared to do anything about it then.
So do you think that your background, your personality played a role in developing the eating disorder? What factors do you think played a part in your not getting treatment right away? I mean, you talked about not feeling like you're sick enough or maybe worthy enough to take people's time. You know, talk about that a little bit.
Definitely. And I think that's a great question. I'm a very, very motivated person. I'm self-driven. I don't require encouragement from other people to do anything or to reach my goals, and I never have. So I would say I've always been a lot harder on myself than anybody else has. I'm my own worst critic, and I have a tendency to not want to burden other people, particularly with my emotions. So I think that my eating disorder was kind of a manifestation of, how do I deal with the problems in my own life? I don't have any coping mechanisms. I don't feel like I can, you know, express my emotions. I don't want to tell anyone else what's going on. So I internalized it. And I think that my tendency towards perfectionism and need for control and inability to have that control is definitely a contributing factor. I think it's a gross misrepresentation to say that everybody with an eating disorder has the same personality, but I think that a lot of us are very similar. I think it would, you know, I don't know, I'm not an expert, but most of the people I've met with eating disorders are a lot like me.
If you can, like, paint a picture for us, what was life like when you were at the lowest point in your struggle with eating disorder?
You know, that's pretty hard to do. I would say there were really two low points. I struggled with both anorexia and bulimia, so I'll tell you about both, I guess. My anorexia was the worst when I was in college. In my freshman year, I am not, believe it or not, I'm not a person who loves exercising. I never really liked working out. And in college, I definitely didn't. But it got to the point where I was eating, you know, one Subway sandwich a day. I had lunch with my boyfriend every day. And so I would eat, you know, the bare minimum, like healthiest sub that Subway had. And just so he could see me eat, and then spend, you know, 2 to 3 hours on the elliptical, because God forbid I was going to run. I certainly wasn't running, but no, I got no, but I would get on the elliptical, and it went on that way for months and months until my roommate confronted me about it and told me that she was going to tell my mom. And I said, okay, well, she thinks she's going to tell my mom. Well, we'll see. So that was actually the main trigger that pushed me over to bulimia, because I realized that it was much easier to hide. So I started just throwing up everything I was eating, and bulimia actually is defined as binging on food. So eating a vast quantity of food and then purging it, either through the use of laxatives or excessive exercise or vomiting. But I never binged. I would just eat a normal amount of food and then purge. So the lowest point of that for me actually was probably a couple years ago. I guess I would say around the same time that I was getting divorced and just starting to run.
Well, I appreciate you
and,
being willing to
talk
about
literally
this.
Everything I ate,
it's gonna help
I threw
a lot
up
of people, and
I,
there's no
I,
telling,
I don't want to say
know,
I felt like
and
that
our
was
audience
normal.
Is going to need to hear
but,
your story, and it's going to mean a lot to them, I think.
Definitely. Yeah. The minute I started reading your blog posts, it was just like, wow, this is something that needs to get out there, that, you know, people need to stop covering up and, you know, start being aware of. So,
yeah.
Well, that's the thing that really, you know, affected me. I mean, it's not something that I would say I'm shy about talking about one-on-one, but it's also not something I wanted the internet to necessarily know. But what I realized is just people have no concept of what it's like. Because for so many people, it's just unimaginable. You know, the idea of throwing up everything you eat or starving yourself or binge eating, I mean, that's a disorder as well. And it's so hard for many people to relate that I just felt like, you know what, it doesn't matter if it's hard for me to talk about, because it's important for me to talk about. And I'm lucky enough to have a forum where I can do that. So I just felt like I needed to take the opportunity while I had it.
I think that's wonderful. Now tell us a little bit about how common eating disorders are and what the most common ones are and whether you think this is an issue in the running community or not.
Okay. Well, actually, the most common eating disorder is actually binge eating disorder. It's newly classified this year, actually, in I think it's called like the Doctors of Psychiatry Manual, but DSM-5, I don't know. Anyway, that's newly classified, and that's estimated to affect as many as 5% of the population right now, which is huge.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, and That's pretty tremendous. And that's characterized by just chronic, you know, overeating of food. I mean, just vast quantities, like things you would never think about, like driving through a drive-thru and getting 10 cheeseburgers and two orders of fries and then going home and eating an entire pizza on top of that. And people are doing this to bury the feelings that they have in the same way that, you know, I throw up my food or an anorexic would starve themselves. The feelings are the same, but the behaviors are different. And that's definitely the most common eating disorder right now. As far as the running community goes, there is evidence to support that there are higher incidence of eating disorders among college athletes, which has been a study that's been done several times. But I do think in the running community and really any athletic community where there's evidence that shows that a lower weight is going to enhance your performance, I mean, there's that pressure to lose weight. I mean, how many times have we heard that, you know, you lose 2 seconds a mile, or I guess you run 2 seconds a mile faster for every pound you lose. I mean, right. I've read that 1,000 times in this world, you know? And so it's like, wow, well, if I lose 10 pounds, that's 20 seconds a mile faster. And there, you know, there goes my PR. And it's really easy to become obsessed with that and that notion. And if you have the right environmental and genetic factors, it's pretty easy to push that into an eating disorder for sure.
Because runners tend to be very, you know, self-motivated, driven, maybe have those type A personalities. And so, like you said, it can be easy to over-control areas of your life, like maybe your eating as well.
Exactly. And it's definitely something that, you know, I would say we probably deal with a little bit more than the average population, but it's serious. And it's something that we need to be telling our kids about, because if you're, you know, have your child run cross country, you know, there's that pressure, and the younger you are, the more impressionable you are and the easier it is for eating disorders to come about. So it's really important to know what the signs are.
Exactly. Now, in one of your blog posts, you state pretty candidly that you say, I hate my body. Do you still feel this way about your body, or are you slowly coming to peace with your shape over time?
You know, that's a tough question to answer. I would say both. You know, part of me always is going to want to be that really thin, waif-like girl that I think I could be, but I'm not, you know? And part of me is really developing a respect for what my body can do. And I would say that running has tremendously helped me in that area, because instead of focusing on what my body isn't, I'm focusing on what it is and what it can do. And the reality is that right now, I have to eat a certain amount to support marathons. I mean, you have to eat, you have to train. And I had a stress fracture due to poor nutrition. So I know that it's right around the corner for me if I don't keep, you know, my nutrition on track. And if I want to keep doing what I love doing, then I have to take care of my body. So in that sense, I'm getting better. You know, every day's a struggle. I'm not going to pretend like I look in the mirror and say like, yes, you look so hot, but you know, cause that's not true. But I also don't hate everything about myself. And it's a constant process, but one that I'm working on for sure.
So maybe it's kind of developing into more respect for what your body can do. Maybe it's not to the love part yet, but you know,
yes,
eventually it'll get there, hopefully.
Yes. I would say it's more of a respect thing at this point. And you know, I think some of that is normal, and you know, I don't think any of us are totally happy with our bodies. I mean, even people that we look at and think are perfect are probably insecure in some way. So, you know, I'm not striving to ever think that I'm the hottest person on the planet, but it would be nice to look in the mirror and feel satisfied with what I see. So that's what I'm working on right now.
That's excellent.
So what things have been helpful in promoting recovery, and what things are not so helpful?
No, I would say the biggest thing is it's helpful, and I can't speak for everyone, but for me, it's helpful when people hold me accountable. I mean, if I've opened up to you and spoken to you about my eating disorder, to me, it's hurtful when people pretend like I never said anything. And I know that seems strange to say, but the reality is it's an awkward conversation to have. It's awkward for my boyfriend to ask me, you know, if I threw up today. He doesn't want to do that. You know, that's like weird, and he's afraid I'm going to get mad at him. But if he pretends like nothing ever happened, it makes me feel like, wow, does he not think this is a big deal? Maybe it isn't a big deal. You know, am I not sick enough? And it gets back to that whole mentality that I'm not worthy of people's time and I'm not worthy of their concern. And so I would say for me, something that's really helpful is just people ask me how I'm doing and not being afraid to bring it up and, you know, confront the fact that I have struggled in the past. But the reality is if I'm willing to talk to you about it in the first place, I'm willing to let you ask me about it again later on. But another thing that's really helpful is people using the correct language, I would say. And that's a little bit strange, but what I mean by that is, you know, people have a tendency to talk to eating disorder patients about body image and complain about how they feel about themselves and bring up dieting and weight loss because they feel like someone with an eating disorder will understand. And we do understand, but the problem is, sorry, that's my dog. The problem is that it's also a huge trigger, and hearing about other people's diets and their weight loss goals and, oh, they hate their body. Well, why do they hate their body? Gosh, I hate mine. You know, that's not helpful. And so I would say, people talking about weight and diets and numbers of calories, I hate that conversation because that's in my mind all the time. So if I'm around people that do that a lot, that's hard for me. So I try to avoid people that can't talk about anything other than weight loss, basically.
So you probably don't watch The Biggest Loser very often.
I do watch Biggest Loser. Funny you mentioned that. And, that's a little, for me, that's different. I think those people are trying to overcome what I'm trying to overcome in a way. A lot of those people probably have some type of emotional attachment to food. And so I don't see that as being the same thing. I'm talking about people who like are constantly like, oh my gosh, I need to lose 2 pounds. I'm not going to fit in this dress. I can't believe how many calories are in that burrito that you're eating. I could never eat that. If that's the type of thing. Oh my gosh, you'd be amazed how many people have said that to me. You know, when you go to like Chipotle or Moe's, I get the biggest burrito because I'm hungry. I run a lot and I need food. And people are like, oh, I would be so fat if I ate that. I'm like, oh, great. You know, and stuff like that is just, it makes you self-conscious, you know, and you don't want to feel like people are judging how much you're eating. And that stuff stresses me out more than it probably should. But I love The Biggest Loser, and I'm so guilty of eating like dessert food while watching it. Like every.
Why is that? We can't sit there and like do push-ups while we watch The Biggest Loser. You just sit there and like eat something.
I know. Like I'm so inspired as I eat ice cream. Like totally can get healthy tomorrow. Yeah, I'm definitely guilty of that.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
No.
Now you've done a 6-part series so far on your blog about the topic of your eating disorder, and you've also delved into. You know, a lot of really important background information about eating disorders too. And I know I've had friends with eating disorders and I've always felt at a loss for what to say. You know, they say something and it's like shocking and it just kind of sets me back on my heels and I don't want to be come across as being judgmental.
Right.
I don't know what to say. So, you know, what is helpful when you're talking with a person who has either a disordered body image or an eating disorder? And what is hurtful? I know you've, you know, mentioned a couple of things already, but kind of go into that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing that's really helpful is to not talk about the person's appearance. You want to avoid sounding accusatory and condescending for sure, because people with eating disorders most of the time recognize that they're kind of alone in their thought process. I mean, it's not normal. And most of us are cognizant enough to realize that. So one thing that I found for myself is I didn't trust people. You know, if someone told me I looked great, I would think they were lying, or I would think that they were trying to trick me into eating more. Or like if somebody said, oh, you look so skinny, like I'd be excited about it. But then also like, well, they're just saying that so I eat, you know, and it was just it's things like that. You really want to try to avoid coming at it from the side of you're doing something wrong. You want to come at it from a place of concern is what I would say would be the most helpful. So rather than saying, oh my gosh, you've gotten so skinny, you need to eat. You want to say like, hey, I noticed, you know, last Wednesday, it seemed like you, skipped lunch and this week I noticed the same thing and I'm really concerned. You know, is there anything you want to talk about? Something like that is more helpful coming from a place of caring rather than I don't like what you're doing and I'm going to make you stop. Because unfortunately with eating disorders, recovery really has to come from the person with the problem. I mean, it's like drug addiction. If the person who has the issue doesn't want to change, they're not going to change. Right. So you can't force somebody to do that. So the most important thing is maintaining those open lines of communication and making this person feel like they can trust you. trust you to not judge them, trust you to support them. And that doesn't mean condoning the behavior. You know, don't get me wrong. I don't think someone should skip a meal and then you high five them. I mean, that's not what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
Yeah. I just mean, you know, rather than constantly accusing or being like, I just heard you throwing up in the bathroom. I mean, okay, that's a great example, actually. So if you come to my house and you hear me throwing up my food, which you won't currently because I just had surgery, so it's not even possible. But if you did and you came and said, I know what you just did and that's not okay. That's not going to put me in a place where I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. You're right. That wasn't okay. You know, I'm going to be like, well, what do you know? You don't know anything about me. And something, I'm going to be more combative because you've come at me in a combative way. But if you were to say to me, you know, it breaks my heart to hear you do that. You know, I'm really concerned about you. I know a lot of the health issues that can come up from vomiting. And every time I hear that, it makes me really sad. Is there anything I can do to get you help? Something like that. I'm going to be like, oh my gosh, like this person really cares about me. You know, they want to make sure I get better. And that type of approach is going to be a lot more effective than not, I would say. So just coming from a place of concern and understanding, because the reality is if you care enough about the person to say something, then you care enough about them to do it in the right way and to take the time to do it in the right way. And it's hard to do that when you're scared. And I definitely understand that. And for families and friends of people with eating disorders, it's very difficult, but it's very important as well.
So are there some stereotypes that people have about eating disorders?
Oh my gosh, where do you want me to start?
just a couple, maybe.
Yeah, you know, I would say the biggest one is that everyone with an eating disorder is skinny. I mean, we think of eating disorders as anorexia, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, when eating disorder pops in your head, the first thing you think is some skeletal white girl with probably blonde hair. And that's what everyone thinks of. And that's not even close to being the reality. Anorexia is the most rare of the eating disorders, actually. And also, people can be anorexic and be a normal body weight. I mean, the behaviors can be there even if your body isn't showing what you expect it to do. And things like binge eating disorder, we expect maybe those people to be extremely overweight, but they're not always. You know, everybody's body metabolizes differently and works differently. Bulimics actually most of the time are normal weight or slightly above average weight. So if you're looking and your friend looks normal and you're thinking, well, they don't have an eating disorder. If they do, they're not very good at it. I've heard that before too.
Oh man.
And people think that because they think that you should be losing this drastic amount of weight, and that's just not reality. So I would say that's by far the biggest one. And then the second is that it only affects women, and that's not true. 10% of eating disorder patients, I think is the number, are men. And, you know, it's already a difficult enough disease to talk about, but when everybody thinks it's a girl disease, it's even worse. I can't even imagine what the men with eating disorders must go through. I can't even begin to think. The resources just aren't there right now. It's just not recognized. So that's hard. And then the other one I would say is that eating disorder patients are vain. I hear that a lot. People confuse it as a vanity issue. They think somebody just wants to lose weight, so they'll be thin, and guys will notice them, and, you know, silly things like that. And that's not even close to being the case. I mean, you know, everybody probably wants to lose 5 pounds, let's say, but are you really going to throw up everything you eat or eat 100 calories a day to attain that? No, of course not. It's about control and deep emotional issues, and vanity is not among them.
That's excellent, because I think, like you said, these things get floated out there, and, you know, for a guy who's trying to maybe get help, you know, so many barriers to overcome mm-hmm. in just people's mentality and mindset. And so if someone listening to this right now has an eating disorder or knows somebody with an eating disorder, what should they do? Are there any resources that you recommend people connect with?
There are a ton of resources out there. And one that I would recommend starting with is the National Eating Disorder Association, NEDA. They are so active, and their website is extremely helpful. They're on Twitter. I mean, they post, they're constantly, they're everywhere. And if you start just with their website alone, you can get some background information about, you know, what is an eating disorder? What are the symptoms? And then some great conversational tips on what to say to somebody with an eating disorder, where a patient can go for help. So if you're struggling right now, they have those resources, not only nationally, but in your state, can show you where to turn. And, you know, everybody's different. And some people are going to be comfortable calling a hotline and some aren't. And for me, I wasn't. So, you know, I've gone to so many different treatment centers. And once I made the decision that I really needed to make an effort to get healthy on my own, and it wasn't anybody else's decision by that point, I got online and I Googled, you know, eating disorder specialist, South Carolina. And I just started looking and I read reviews and I just tried to educate myself. Again, it's that research thing, on who was around that could help me and had experience helping me. And there's just a ton of information on NIDA's website, but also, you know, Google. And pretty much any major city at this point is going to have a pretty decent number of resources, and college campuses are really helpful too. So there's a lot of hope out there and a lot of help. You just have to kind of know where to look, and the internet's a great place for that. It's scary, but it's a great place for it too.
And then I'm sure it's also important to have a good support system of people in your life. Like you talked about accountability earlier. So what should a person struggling with an eating disorder do about people who are more harmful than helpful?
That's a really, really difficult question, because it's a really crappy answer, honestly. And I've struggled with this a lot, but the reality is, you know, I'm a person who's always going to give somebody second chances, and I don't believe that you can hold people accountable for what they don't know. So in my opinion, if you expect everybody to always say the right thing, but they don't know that you're struggling, well, that's kind of naive. So you do have to open up a little bit. And if you're not ready to do that, then just don't be around those people. But if you are ready and you have a friend who, let's say, is constantly bringing up, you know, the weight and the appearance and all of those things that are triggers for you, you know, sit down with that friend. And I did this recently, sat down with a friend of mine and I just said, look, you know, it's really triggering for me and difficult for me to hear you talk about calories and needing to work out more and needing to lose weight. You know, I explained to her my situation, and, at that point in time, she didn't realize what an issue it really was. And I don't think she realized how serious it was. And it continued to be a problem. And I continued to say, hey, this isn't okay with me. And eventually we had to stop talking until she realized that, hey, this is not going to go away for me. And now we have a great relationship and she does respect that. But treatment and recovery is difficult enough when you have a support system. The last thing you need is people that are going to bring you down. And anybody that doesn't recognize how serious this is and how deadly it is, honestly, there's no place for them in your life. So I realize that's easier said than done, but I've been in a position to have to do it many times. So, you know, I would say really, if people can't, after repeated conversations, be that helpful support system, then you shouldn't have them around. Bottom line.
I think that's excellent. You know, probably for people struggling with any number of issues, you have to surround yourself with the right kind of people to get where you want to be in your life.
So Definitely. That's
excellent. Now, is it still a constant battle to quiet those negative voices that are in your head, or does it, you know, gradually get better over time? And just kind of walk us through what your personal journey to recovery looks like.
I would say that it does get better over time. I'm not, you know, I read these stories online, these recovery stories about women who don't struggle anymore. And I'm going to be honest, for me, that's seems far away, but I can tell you that the voices have definitely gotten quieter, and it sounds kind of crazy to say that, but, it's just not as overwhelming anymore. And I've learned to recognize those voices and learn to recognize that self-talk. And I'm going to be honest, there's days when I embrace it. There's days when I do not care about myself and I don't feel good about myself and I let those voices take over. But now, more often than not, I'm just like, shut up, you know,
yeah.
I'm skinny. I run, you know, I'm a cute girl, and just try to remind myself of those things. And, you know, I think the biggest problem with eating disorders is that, you know, in a way it's similar to like drug addiction or alcoholism, but food is the addiction. And the problem is you don't need drugs or alcohol to live, but you do need food. So, you know, eating disorder patients are confronted with their drug of choice one way or another at least 3 times a day.
Right.
So, you know, we're constantly having to make the right choice over and over and over again. And anybody who's ever been on a diet or tried to follow a training plan or tried to do anything hard, you know, there's some days when you just feel like you can't do it anymore. You just want to give up, and constantly having to make that choice is difficult. So I would say for me at this point, my recovery is more about controlling behavior and quieting thoughts. At this point, I don't worry as much about the thoughts, and I just worry about changing the behavior. So let's say I have a day when I feel really bad about myself and I'm really stressed out, really anxious, and the voice in my head is just telling me, you're fat, you're gross, go throw up your food or whatever. I acknowledge that voice and I try to say, okay, I know that's what I want to do right now, but can I make it through this meal? Right. Just focus on this meal. You can throw up the next one. And I just take it one meal at a time. Cause honestly, if I spent the rest of my life thinking, well, you just have to never throw up again for 30 more years or 50 more years or whatever. That's so overwhelming. That's like being at mile one of a marathon and thinking only 25.2 more to go, like that's terrible. You're like going to want to quit if you do that. So I take it one meal at a time and then one day at a time and, try to control the behavior and hope that the thoughts go away over time. And they are, slowly, but I've been doing this for 10 years. So it's, and I'm not trying to discourage people at all because I fully believe recovery is possible. If I didn't believe it, I wouldn't be talking about it and I wouldn't be trying to do it, but, it is a battle and it's not something that goes away in 6 months. It's not just like you snap your fingers and, oh, I remember what a cheeseburger tasted like. Well, now I'm better. It's really not that simple. If it was, it wouldn't be an eating disorder. So
well, I think the most hope you can give people is to tell them the truth and be realistic about it. It's like training for a marathon. You have to tell people it's not going to be easy. There's going to be times you're going to want to quit, but it's going to be worth it in the end. And the same thing is true for trying to recover. There's going to be tough moments when you want to quit, but the end result is what you're working towards.
Exactly. And for me, that end result is, I want to have kids someday. I say that. I'm not totally sure because they kind of scare me. But in theory, I want to have kids someday. And I want to set a good example for them. I'm terrified of having a child that has an eating disorder. And, the worst part about it is to think that I could possibly do something that would encourage it. And so for me, it's getting healthy for my future kids, for my boyfriend at this point, who's amazing, and just owing it to myself to get better and owing it to my future, because I don't want to have to deal with this for the rest of my life. It's really not fun. So I want to get better and have a future where hopefully I don't have to spend as much time thinking about it. Cause right now I spend a lot of time. So.
Well, since you've started sharing your story on your blog, what has the response been like?
The response has been really amazing. And, I'm so glad you asked that because I knew that writing this was really important, but I was really concerned because I know the stereotypes of eating disorder patients and I know how whiny and dramatic this type of thing can sound. And, the reality is I had a very charmed childhood. My parents were fairly wealthy growing up. Yeah. I mean, I really didn't have any of the typical problems that you think of. And that was a huge source of guilt for me because I'm like, well, what's wrong with me that this is going on? Why do I have issues? I shouldn't, I wasn't abused, nothing like that. So I was really worried that people were just going to think like, oh my God, I can't shut up, skinny, like girl, just stop talking. We don't care. I was terrified. I remember posting the first blog and just shaking and I got such an incredible response from people, especially as the series went on and I kept talking about my story. And, the most amazing thing to me it's not really been the number of people that have identified because I'm pretty aware of how many people struggle. It's pretty easy for me to recognize and I know it's a bigger problem than most people think. So I wasn't as surprised by that. What I was surprised by was the number of people and especially men who commented and said, you have completely changed the way I look at eating disorders. I was one of those people who thought it was about vanity or thought it was about boys or whatever. And I'm so glad that you wrote this because I have daughters and I want to help them. And I want to make sure that they don't feel this way about themselves. And the support I've gotten has been, unequivocal. I haven't gotten a single negative comment. So far, I haven't had anybody say, shut up and stop writing about this. I've had just overwhelming support and gratitude. And I'm really just so thankful and pleased that it's touched so many people. I that's exactly what I wanted, and I've got it. So I'm just glad it's helping people.
I think we really touched a nerve out there, and that's one of the reasons when I read the series, I thought, wow, there are so many people in the Marathon Training Academy audience that have to be dealing with this or know somebody, and I just want people to be equipped with tools on how to help themselves or help someone else. Yeah. And so we're definitely going to link to your blog, and I'm looking forward to the next installment in your series as well.
Great. Yeah, it's, you know, it's, these take a lot out of me. It's hard for me to write them because they are so personal, but they're so important. And, I think I've really thought out each segment. And my reasons for writing them are very specific, not only to help people relate to my story and feel like they're not alone, but, just to really break up some of the things that I hear so commonly, the jokes that people make and the assumptions that they have. And, you know, I know from talking to friends of mine who had no idea that I had an eating disorder that they were horrified because they're like, oh my gosh, I've said those things to you and I was just kidding and I didn't realize. And nobody wants to be in that position. You know, you feel awful thinking you've hurt somebody. And so I wrote, one of the more popular posts in the series has been called, it's one called Say What? And it's just about what to say and what not to say and why it hurts people with eating disorders, because I think it's really hard. It's really hard for people to relate if they don't suffer. And it's hard to understand why certain things would be, offensive or detrimental. I mean, one of the things, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little off topic, but one of the things is, when I saw my mom after I transferred colleges and I was getting treatment, when I came back and I saw her, she said, "Oh my gosh, Danielle, you look so healthy." I was like, "What? I look healthy? Dear, you know, oh my gosh, kill me." You know, that was like fat. Healthy was fat, you know, and my mom was saying it as a compliment. She's like, she meant to say, "You look great. You look alive. You look vibrant." But what I heard was, "You look fat." And something so seemingly innocuous to the general population is, you know, just like a dagger in the heart to an eating disorder patient. And I wanted to shed some light on just little things like that, because they can make a huge difference.
Yeah, that's excellent. So you recently underwent surgery and you're probably still healing up and figuring out what the rest of the year is going to look like for you. I'm curious to know, if you could run any race in the world, which one would it be and why?
That's a really hard question to answer, and I'm not sure I know the answer, but I will say right now, I would love to run Boston having qualified for it. I will not run Boston unless I qualify. So for me, that would be one that I would love to do. Right now, it seems completely unattainable, but that would be a dream come true for me. I guess that's kind of boring. You know, I should probably say like Paris or something, but Boston would be pretty awesome.
That's what I would pick too at this point in my life. Is I can relate to that.
Yeah, it seems ridiculous, but maybe one day.
I always figure someday my age and my speed will coincide, hopefully.
I hope so. Gosh, not at the rate I'm going, but, you know, actually, and you didn't ask this, but just so you know, actually the surgery that I underwent was actually a pretty big deal as far as my eating disorder goes, because there is a pretty high chance, it's about 50%, that I won't ever be able to throw up again. So, and it's done that way on purpose to fix my reflux, but that was a huge mental barrier for me, because getting this surgery meant essentially that I was giving up bulimia. And, you know, if I did try to make myself throw up, I could actually like not explode my stomach, but cause serious damage and have to have the surgery redone and potentially have really bad complications. So the decision to do this was a hard one for me. And I'd be lying if I said I'm not concerned about where I think it'll go in the future, because I am. And my mom asked me, she said, "Well, what are you going to do if you have a bad day and you're, you know, desperate to throw up and you can't?" She's like, you literally cannot force yourself to throw up. I said, "I don't know what I'm going to do, but I guess we're going to find out, because I'm not willing to live the rest of my life feeling sick all the time and constantly being nauseous and having this awful reflux." And so I feel like that was a really big step in my recovery, being able to say, you know what, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm committed enough to recovery and to myself that I want to find out. So this is a pretty big deal.
That's excellent. It's kind of like you're slamming the door and locking it pretty much on bulimia. And, you know, you're going to have to find new coping mechanisms in the future. But
exactly.
Sometimes you have to make that step into the unknown and, you know, you rediscover that there's so much more out there. And, you know, it really opens up a whole nother world for you. So we're definitely pulling for you and your continued recovery. And it's always exciting to get another blog post from you.
Well, thank
and
you.
Maybe one of these days we will coincide at a race. Who knows? Maybe soon.
Yeah, well, now I hear about St. Louis. I don't know. I'll keep you posted.
Yes, I would definitely love to meet you at some point. So we really appreciate you coming on the podcast with us.
Sure. It was great. And I really appreciate y'all asking me. And I'm just so glad that this information can get out there and hopefully help a lot more people.
Well, that concludes our conversation with T-Rex runner Daniel Hastings. It's been a different, you know, kind of episode today. It's something we've never talked about before, you know, eating disorders. And it was really interesting to me. It's a whole world that I wasn't really aware of. I've never had an eating disorder or really know anyone personally who has. But it really opened my eyes to what these people struggle with and how serious it is.
Definitely. I've had friends with eating disorders, and you really feel helpless in what to say and what to do. And I know, like many women, I've struggled with definitely a negative body image. And so, you know, a lot of these things hit close to home for probably many people in our listening audience. So, you know, for more information, we'd encourage you to check out Danielle's blog over at trexrunner.com. She has a 6-part series on eating disorders, and I think it'll be really helpful for you if you want more information to visit over there.
Yeah, and we'd also love to have your feedback on this episode. If you want to stop by our Facebook page and leave us a message, or stop by our blog and leave a comment. Tell us what you thought of the interview. That'd be great. Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip, and Angie's going to talk about pacing bands. What is a pacing band?
Well, we all know that one of the keys to running a great race is to run an even pace, or even a negative split, where you run the second half of your race faster than the first half. And I actually got this quick tip from a listener. He said, "I found a great quick tip. I love your podcast. I've been listening for a couple of months now. I'm not sure if you've ever covered this one, but I'm trying to do my first marathon and want to follow a pacing schedule during the race to get to my goal finish time, which was less than 4 hours. He says, "I was going to write my paces on my arm with a waterproof marker, but then I found printable pacing band creators online. You put in your finishing time and you get a printable file, which you cut out with scissors, use packaging tape, and then attach to your wrist like a bracelet. Voila, a homemade pacing bracelet. Waterproof, professional looking, and free." And that was sent in by Andrew, and I thought that is a really good tip. You know, you've seen maybe those pacing tattoos that you can put on your arm, and there's different methods of people trying to, you know, figure out how they should be staying on their splits as far as their miles go. So this is a great way. You can wear it on your wrist and keep yourself on track, and you can use it for any race distance as well. You just put in your race distance and what you want your finishing time to be, and the bracelet runs for you.
Yeah, right.
I wish.
So you just taping a piece of paper on your wrist?
No, you print out this paper. You cut it out. It's like this narrow strip.
Right.
And then you kind of like laminate it.
And tape it
with
to your
packaging
wrist.
Tape and just, yeah, attach it around your wrist. So you just have to look down at your wrist like you would at your watch. And, you know, you look at mile 2, you should be at a certain time, etc. I've used one before.
That is amazingly low tech.
Amazingly genius. It's better than writing on your arm with a waterproof marker your splits, you know.
So you can go to this paceband creator and just plug in your splits, and it just will give you a printable document.
What you do is you plug in what the race distance is, mm-hmm. and what you want your finishing time to be.
It'll even figure out your splits.
It'll figure out your splits. That's the beauty of it. No math involved.
So if you're too lazy to use Microsoft Word and a calculator, you can go to pacebandcreator.com.
And aren't we all too lazy? It's an offshoot of the Marathon Guide website, which is completely awesome anyway. So just another reason to visit marathonguide.com.
All right. Well, thanks for that quick tip. If you'd like more information on running and marathon training, visit us at marathontrainingacademy.com. And when you're there, you can download a free audio gift called The 7 Pillars of Successful Marathon Training. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Remember, you do have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Well on my way, well on my way.
Away.